the market has evolved tremendously. The United States supply chain has evolved tremendously. So that's the first reason we are highly convicted that the United States warehouse product as a whole is outdated. There has been a lot built, but more will need to be built. And the technological needs of our tenants continues to evolve, and those buildings will continue to evolve. So there is a lot of room under the pedal, especially as we look at the next 5, 10, and 15 years.
Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group, a leading provider of commercial real estate intelligence. Along with Omar El-Tarai, our Senior Director of Research, we have another great episode for you. We're excited to dig into industrial sector trends with Asif Badeh of Ambrose. Asif is the founder and CEO of Ambrose, a national real estate investment firm focused on Class A industrial and logistics space. Since starting the company in 2008, he's built it into a $3.5 billion platform with over 30 million square feet, serving clients like Amazon and First Solar. He's also been named a GlobeStreet.com influencer in industrial real estate and serves on several industry and community boards. Asif, thank you so much for being on CRE Exchange with us.
Absolutely. You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So welcome to the podcast, Asif. Let's start with some of your background. You've built Ambrose from a three-person startup in 2008 to one of the fastest growing real estate firms in the country with a massive $3 billion development platform. Can you take us back to the founding moment? What really drove you to start Ambrose?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for those kind words. If it's okay, I'll actually give you a little bit more background than that and give you maybe several moments that led to that special moment in November of 2008 when I started the company. I'm sitting here in Indianapolis, Indiana, where we're headquartered, and that's where I was born and raised. My parents are immigrants. And really, the first moment that comes to mind, what made me so interested in warehouses was actually as a little kid growing up, my dad worked in one on the west side of Indianapolis. And at the age of 8, he let me come along with him to when he was picking up a tool or something like that from work. And I, being a curious little kid, was extremely excited about all the really neat machinery and the really high ceilings, not nearly as high as the ones that are built today. But looking at that big cavernous warehouse, I excitedly told my dad that I wanted to figure out how to work there one day. And being the immigrant dad, hard-nosed guy that he was, he immediately gave me the American dream speech and told me that he wanted me to figure out how to own buildings like that one day. So that was the very first time that I ever thought about getting into the real estate industry. That building was owned by a company that was headquartered in Indianapolis for 50 years, was acquired by Prologis a few years ago, Duke Realty. And fast forwarding about 10 years after that moment in that warehouse, I had the opportunity to get an internship at Duke Realty at the age of 18 through a program called Inroads, which I had the opportunity to, in essence, turn into a co-op program. I worked throughout the school year during my years at Indiana University and just really got a fabulous start to my career at Duke, learned a lot, fabulous mentors, really started to understand the business, went to work there full time. And about 5 years later, after working there full time at the age of 26, as the economy was in complete meltdown, I decided it was a good time to start a new real estate company. So I, of course, had that kind of story and inspiration from my parents that anything is possible. The other side of it that's really important to note, though, is that I really saw an opportunity at that time to build something new, to build something with fresh perspective. And I really wanted to figure out how I could build something where we could make things extremely easy for tenants and do the things that the big, large core funds and publicly traded REITs could not or would not do. And so that's what I set out to do. At that age, not sure that I really knew exactly what I was getting myself into. I frankly did not, but it's turned out to be a great move and a great journey.
Is that the people first kind of guiding principle that you emphasize, whether it's in your bio or I've heard you emphasize it on other podcasts as well? You wanted to do something different. And is that people first component, whether it's for the tenants or for your investors? Is that one of the key differentiators that you set out to build?
I think it is. Our business is built by people. Our buildings are built by people. We invest on behalf of people. Ultimately, these large pensions whose capital we're investing on behalf of, those are all people, right? And turning back to the story with my dad had a small pension, right? My dad had a warehouse job. And at the end of the day, yes, all of those people, those thousands of people that work in and on the buildings as they're being built, I think about those people often when we make investment decisions and try to figure out what is the best thing to do as we make those investment decisions.
So Asif, how about you walk us through the company today? Tell us more about your core investment thesis, maybe your geographic focus and your vertically integrated firm. So what are some of the competitive advantages that come with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Our heritage as a firm, we are deeply rooted real estate people. We are, of course, an investment manager today, a vertically integrated investment manager. We are focused on investing in one thing and one thing only, and those are modern industrial warehouses throughout the United States. So we don't deal in even 25-year-old warehouses, right? So we're very narrowly focused, and I will come back to that at some point later in our conversation. But today we operate the business with kind of two parallel businesses. One is a national built-to-suit business. That business has a geographic focus that is determined by the clients it serves. The client calls us, they say, hey, we need a building in XYZ County at this in this 1 mile radius. Please go find us a site and build us this exact building. And we have a team of people that goes and does that. And our reach is quite wide there. We operate literally throughout the United States, from Washington State to Florida, or from the West Coast to the East Coast in that business. The other parallel business that we have is where we have strategic positions in certain markets. Those markets are concentrated in the Southeast, primarily Florida, the state of Florida, the mountain states. So Denver, Salt Lake City, Phoenix, those types of markets in the Mountain West region. And then the Midwest, Columbus, Ohio, Cincinnati, Ohio, Indianapolis, Louisville, Kentucky, so on and so forth. In those places, we have boots on the ground. We have people that are speaking with brokers and tenants and landowners every single day. We're evaluating purchases of existing buildings. Those are markets where we are highly active, very much hands-on, and we are making investments in land and building speculatively even before a tenant has necessarily asked us to be there. So that's how we split up the business.
In 2019, you pivoted away from mixed use and office and to now what you do, which is exclusively industrial, kind of modern warehouse. Was there a particular market force or trend that really drove that decision for you guys?
I'd love to say that I foresaw what was going to happen with office and mixed use product beginning in 2020, but I did not have a crystal ball and did not predict that. I would, joking aside, we define our purpose as a company to redefine what's possible for people, communities, and companies. And as I evaluated, looked at what we had accomplished in the first decade, which was primarily focused on development in Indianapolis and nearby areas, one thing that I felt like we could do to further enhance the delivery and accomplishment of that purpose over the following decade of Ambrose's existence for between 2019 and 2030, in essence, I knew that our geographic reach was one key way we could do that. And I felt like another thing that we had to do in order to accomplish the first was to raise institutional capital to efficiently navigate that growth and efficiently execute on that geographic reach. And then third, as I had considered what almost all of the best investors in the world harp on, if you were to look at or listen to what you would hear over and over again, it's the F word, which is focus. And it became very evident to me that if we could focus on one thing and one thing only, we would be able to, number one, serve our clients in a phenomenal way. And number two, we would mitigate risk because I and the rest of my colleagues would wake up every single day and our brain would be focused on one product type, one customer base, so on and so forth. And so it became clear in 2019 that, or 2018 to me, that was the decision that was necessary. We executed on that change in 2019. We're off to the races by the end of 2019. And since that moment in time, we have nearly 10x'd the company. We have hired a number of people, created a lot of jobs, built millions of square feet. And it's just been we had the final closing on our latest fund, the first quarter of 2025. It's been a really, really special ride since making that pivot to focus exclusively on modern industrial.
So Asif, I want to dig in on that fundraise a little bit. It was $400 million. It was your first institutional fund, largest one to date. Do you mind walking us through the strategy? I know you did mention that this was kind of part of the way to expand your geographic reach as well, one of the reasons that you did. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're nearing 60% deployment on this fund. We are executing on the business that I described a little bit earlier between built-to-suit projects all over the country, and then investments made in strategic markets. Currently, we're investing in seven of those markets in Florida, the Mountain State, and the Midwest. And we had a great set of investors in that fund that we're really excited to be working with. So far, the deployment pacing is going really well. We're finding great opportunities. We are, like with anything, there are always challenges to deal with. And as you, I'm sure you may ask about this later, but the headlines are not wrong. The leasing markets in the industrial space, and frankly, the leasing markets in general, have been challenging over the last few years as interest rates have crept up. Global trade policies have caused a lot of uncertainty and certainly delayed corporate decision-making. We've gone from historic high absorption numbers in that post-COVID boom in the industrial world to some of the worst numbers in quite a while, and it's concerning. But there are some, as I always do, glass half full approach, activity seems to be an all-time high. We will see if this year and the beginning of next year, that activity translates into actual completed transaction volume.
Well, I know Omar's got a few more questions about those, but one thing I did want to ask, and I imagine that things have been made a little bit more interesting by your evolving investor base. This fund now has money from public pensions, insurance companies, family office. Has that really changed your approach to deal making?
One of the things that I learned during this fundraise, which was in a very challenging fundraise environment, our placement agent, Hodis Weil, that they work with some of the best players in the industry. We started conversations on this fundraise in late 22 when the market was still, I would say, okay. It had come off of just a phenomenally hot market in 21 and 22, early 22, and started cooling off. And then we've had a few tough years in the fundraising environment. I think you've probably heard that from a variety of investment managers. Probably the biggest thing I learned during that fundraise is there are tens of thousands of investors out there, millions of investors out there, if you include all the high net worths and family offices and just so many investors all over the world. And I think the biggest thing that I learned is I don't need to convince every one of those investors that my strategy is the right strategy, because frankly, it's not the right strategy for most of those investors. I'm looking for investors with whom we have a common vision, investors that are looking for a product that we are able to deliver with excellence, because that's the way we like to perform. And so I think first and foremost, I would say whether it's a large public pension or it's an ultra high net worth individual, a vast majority of investors are probably not looking for what we have to offer. But the ones that are, that's where there is a match. To dig a little deeper on your question in terms of differentiating between what I'll say is institutional investors, and I would include family offices of a certain size in that grouping. It's an interesting phenomenon because for 10 years, I primarily worked with family office capital and high net worth investor capital, and then pivoted over the last five towards institutional capital. And really, the rest of the investment management world is doing the reverse. So as we lean further and further into institutional capital, I think our peer group in the investment management space, including some of the largest players out there, They are building out a lot of infrastructure to service high net worth individual investors. And it's an interesting phenomenon. I don't know what the right answer is, but sometimes I do. One thing that I've been thinking about a lot is, can you be everything to everyone in that space? And I've asked myself the question of, do I need to think about that F word again? And it's focus important. And can you really serve every single type of investor? And, you know, I'm not as smart as some of the largest players in the industry that are doing what I just described and trying to serve all those investors. But I asked myself that question. And just because you can get the money from those investors, it may or may not be the right fit, you know?
And shifting focus to what is going on in the marketplace, I think industrial plays a key role and has a phenomenal lens into the broader kind of like macro environment. And just looking at your past big decision and life points, whether that's at the bottom of the GFC or getting out of office at kind of, I would say, arguably the peak of office, these are some like stellar decisions. So like, what's your current read on the macro landscape in the U.S.?
Just to zoom out and mention a few numbers, the United States industrial market is comprised of just shy of 18 billion square feet. One key factor that has made us highly convicted on modern industrial is that a very small fraction of that space has been built in the last 10 years, like less than 15%. Less than a third of that space, of that 18 billion square feet, has been built since 2000. And I remember walking into a warehouse very vividly when I started as an intern at Duke Realty in 2000. And the difference between what a warehouse building looks like then, not only the physical space, but what is going on inside of it versus what I saw yesterday when I was meeting with that tenant, the ceiling heights in a lot of buildings has doubled. The amount of power going into those buildings could perhaps be 10x, depending on the tenant and the location and what's going on inside of the building. And then some of the technical features involved in these buildings are technical features necessary for the tenants' supply chains inside of these buildings. A simple one to point out or understand is the flatness of the floor that is necessary for robotic equipment to operate in that building, which is, of course, measured in millimeters. The highly technical changes, and we have a phenomenal team of engineers that could give you literally hundreds of those bullet points, but those are the ones that are easy for me to talk about. The market has evolved tremendously. The United States supply chain has evolved tremendously. So that's the first reason we are highly convicted that the United States warehouse product as a whole is outdated. There has been a lot built, but more will need to be built. And the technological needs of our tenants continues to evolve, and the buildings will continue to evolve. So there is a lot of room under the pedal, especially as we look at the next 5, 10, and 15 years. That's number one. Number two, as you both know, the e-commerce phenomenon has been massively impactful. The United States supply chain, where buildings go, how close they need to be to consumer populations, the features needed in those buildings in terms of parking, truck flow, vans that are going to be delivering product to people's homes maybe 2 hours after they hit buy on their website or app on their phone, and so on and so forth. All of that has driven not only a tremendous amount of space that is needed, but a tremendous amount of space that is needed in very specific locations with very specific building features. And then the last and frankly most recent phenomenon is reshoring and onshoring new manufacturing investments in the United States. There is a lot of that happening. And it is, I mentioned the entire industrial market of 18 billion square feet and the amount of space or the age of that stock. If we were to look at the subset in the United States of manufacturing space, those numbers become much more compelling. The United States manufacturing building stock is extremely old. It's extremely outdated in terms of new modern features, and it's frankly very inefficient. And the things that we have made traditionally as a country have evolved, right? And have evolved a lot in the last 5 or 7 years. So that's the third reason we are highly convicted about investing in modern industrial space in the United States.
So if we're undersupplied for modern industrial, the last couple of years, we've seen some pretty significant changes in terms of high inflation, whether you look at materials or labor or just overall construction inflation, as well as higher cost of financing. How have you been able to manage that? Because you had a very robust development pipeline. How has inflation and higher interest rates affected your business? And how do you kind of try to mitigate some of the risks that those bring?
Sure. Addressing inflation, it's been interesting. I mean, the area where that has impacted our business the most, in my opinion, would be construction costs. And we saw construction costs surge in the post-COVID environment. And then subsequently, we've seen it come down materially. In terms of interest rates, I think more than anything, I think they went up more than anyone maybe expected. Most people don't plan for or want to really think about the worst case, but they went up a lot. And there is a lot of much smarter people than me that are speculating that long-term interest rates are going to stay there. And I am not an economist, and so I can't predict exactly how that'll impact cap rates for a number of years. Cap rates stayed at a level that didn't necessarily make sense. The real answer is, in order to make projects work, rents need to be at a certain level to compensate for interest rates and inflation on construction costs. And we've been able to mitigate that by focusing on locations where we are able to achieve those rents because there's sufficient demand from tenants willing to pay that. As I mentioned to you earlier, the leasing markets have been challenging. It's one of the things that I lose sleep about from time to time, but we continue to see really good tenant activity in the locations that we've selected to invest over the last few years.
Hopefully not making you lose any more sleep, but do you think any markets are overbuilt? So you did a great breakdown of kind of the national market and how, even though we have a lot of industrial space, only a small portion of it is actually modern and really built for the modern economy. Are there markets that actually are overbuilt? Or if you want to answer the flip side of that, are there certain markets that absolutely need significantly more modern industrial?
The short answer is, Omar, yes. There are absolutely markets and submarkets throughout the United States that are overbuilt. One happens to be about 15 miles from my office here in Indianapolis on the east side, where there's several buildings that are available. What the headlines say about various coastal markets, where we're glad we don't invest. There has been overbuilding, which frankly naturally happens when capital is easily accessible. Leasing has been very strong and developers rush in to go vertical on projects. There are a number of markets where there's more supply than demand.
But overall, like the U.S. is actually still pretty undersupplied in terms of that modern industrial that matches the economy that we currently have as well as are building towards.
Yeah, I mean, that's an 18 billion square foot number. Pre-COVID, a typical year on average for a decade or so before COVID on average was, call it 300 to 350 million square feet of absorption, low 300s, let's say, on average. During the COVID boom, I think that average jumped up to 500 million-ish. The last few years has been dismal relative to both of those numbers, more in the run rate for this year. And then last year's actual numbers is more like 100 to 200 million, depending on whose numbers you believe. But the other thing that has happened is new construction starts because of interest rates, inflation, and then the supply and demand imbalance. New supply and new starts has absolutely tanked. And so we believe that by late 26, 27, into 28, so really projects that are started now or let's say in 26 and delivered in those years, that those we believe will be coming into a market where the new supply is almost nothing relative to what it has been. Hopefully there has been leasing that has occurred, and we believe those years will be a good time to start delivering projects.
You already mentioned that the kind of post-COVID boom was followed by a huge absorption. I think some numbers that we have say We reached about 3% for vacancy, and now it's grown to closer to 6. But do you think this is a healthy normalization, or does it worry you for the future?
I think there's always ebbs and flows. Being a developer by heritage, us developers, when we can access capital and there's sufficient demand in the market, we tend to take those risks, start building. We as a platform have very much shied away from that, really beginning in that 2019 timeframe. Omar probably is giving me too much credit, but as we looked at the investment landscape in 2019 and where we were able to sell mixed use projects and land office projects, so on and so forth, as we zoomed out, we felt the risk return was tilted heavily in favor of selling those projects and not buying or building new ones. In 21 and 22, as we were selling industrial projects and selling projects in the high 3s on the cap rate and low 4s everywhere, and seeing tenants ask for rents that generated a high 3s to low 4s to 5% return on cost, we scratched our head and really pulled the throttle back on new development and did not build a ton in that kind of time frame. And then as we saw others cancel projects and slow down, that caused us to say, okay, there's going to be a window of opportunity here. And that's when we turned the machine back into higher gear.
So you've already walked us through some of the kind of leasing trends, but I want to hear, at least on a national level, what are you hearing in terms of rent growth, or maybe if you've already answered that, specifically tenant behaviors? So for your kind of Class A e-commerce product, what are we looking at?
It has been a landlord-friendly market in our space for a while, and I think tenants are maybe appreciating and capitalizing on the opportunity. So there is downward pressure on rents, and particularly in certain submarkets throughout the country, particularly those that I mentioned that are overbuilt. There is still rental growth in still other submarkets, particularly those that, of course, are more constrained on the supply side. From a demand perspective, I've mentioned a few times now that we're seeing high levels of activity. And as we look at kind of the last 3 years or so, I would say activity is at a high point right now, maybe even approaching the pre-COVID normalization, I would say, and maybe even better than that. In terms of the numbers in our portfolio, we have about 2 million square feet of vacant space. We carefully track the level of activity we have. We look at the number of RFPs we're working on, so on and so forth. On that 2 million square feet of vacancy that's under construction or newly built, we're tracking nearly 50 RFP or tenant requirements that have advanced to that stage, right around 9 million square feet of projects. So that feels pretty good. That's a high point. As I mentioned, we have continuously seen corporate decision-making being delayed, projects being delayed and extended. So I would say we are in a wait and see, holding our breath a little bit to see if that activity generates transaction volume. And it'll be very interesting to see how the 25 numbers shape up in terms of absorption and what those activity levels look like going into the first part of next year.
So I know that this is either an uncertain time or a confusing time for folks in our space, and particularly on the industrial side with tariff uncertainty. What are you hearing from tenants? What is their kind of business outlook right now? And how is that impacting your business?
I would say that the thing that we hear the most often is we need to wait and see. Real estate is a fraction of the cost of a supply chain project, both upfront on a capital basis and then an ongoing. The amount of investment typically happening by a company is vast to do a new supply chain project, sometimes in the hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more. And so for a supply chain team to walk into the C-suite and say, hey, we're going to start a $150 or $250 million project, I think there have been a lot of C-suites that have said, yes, but not right now. Can we just delay this decision by 6 months? And then that, of course, has a variety of downstream effects. So I think that is what we're hearing most often in terms of kind of outside of the norm of just tenants making decisions and getting things done. I think just decision-making is taking longer would be the thing that we hear the most often.
And I think the other thing that's shaking the industry up would be AI and technology. Either from one perspective, that's predictive analytics, automation in your business itself, or if it's AI generally. And I know that this has led to new specialized facilities, either data centers or cold storage. What are you implementing in your business specifically, or what are you hearing from tenants too?
I'll start with the tenant side. It is, and I can't share a ton because we have a variety of NDAs in terms of the technical aspects of some of the facilities we do, but I'm still like that 8-year-old kid that walked into the warehouse where my dad worked. But what I see inside of that warehouse today versus what I did 35 years ago when I walked into the warehouse where my dad worked, it's absolutely unbelievable. Just the automation and robotics, layering in how AI is completely changing, even how the robotics and automation works, it's mind-boggling. It is absolutely mind-boggling. In terms of Ambrose, internally, there is a lot of efficiency to be gained, but it's still very inefficient. There's a lot to learn. There's a lot changing on a weekly or monthly basis, it feels like. So we have implemented various AI tools within the company, but we're doing that, I would say, fairly cautiously and trying to really think about the long-term effects of that, doing it right and building it the right way. The area where that's most interesting, at least to me personally, AI has drastically impacted the industrial real estate space in a way that maybe doesn't get talked about that much. It seems like no one really wants a warehouse or a data center in their backyard. And that phenomenon, I would say, is accelerating. And now there's no secret that there is a power shortage in America, and data centers need a lot of power, as do warehouses, not nearly as much. But we control and own about 3,000 acres of land coast to coast in the United States. And it's one of the things, getting that land under control and getting it entitled is one of the biggest value adds of how we're able to deliver excellent returns to our investor clients. And this AI phenomenon has really made land that has power accessibility much more valuable. So it will be interesting to see how it will further impact the industrial space, because land gets taken from the industrial pipeline to become data center or digital powered land. We're seeing a lot of that in our own portfolio, but as an industry, I think that will continue to accelerate impact land availability for industrial development.
What other long-term trends do you see shaping industrial in the U.S.?
I think reshoring and onshoring, we're just beginning to see the impacts of that. I think there's an enormous multiplier effect in terms of a manufacturing facility getting built, but then all of the industrial space that's needed to service that new manufacturing facility, the suppliers, the company itself for raw materials, so on, finished goods, so on and so forth. As you both know, those projects are very large, both in terms of dollar investment and then in terms of just the amount of land they take. So I think that will be another area, depending on exactly how manufacturing growth accelerates. I think that can be extremely impactful here over the next 5 to 10 years.
Are there any catalysts that you're anticipating for that? I know that tariffs are one thing that are really forcing that kind of reconsideration or reassessment of supply chains. But then I think AI and robotics, of like how you're actually going to build it and how you're going to run your supply chain, is huge. But are there any kind of catalysts that you think would really boost or accelerate or allow that trend to take off in a more meaningful way? Or maybe no one clear catalyst, but it's just going to be a gradual kind of rebuild of the U.S.'s manufacturing capabilities?
I think it's the latter primarily. There's a lot of different factors. I do think that we are in a very tumultuous and odd time in terms of just geopolitical temperature around the world. And that impacts our global supply chain very directly, as you both know, when there's risk or question mark on if goods can move from a certain part of the world to another safely. As that situation evolves, I feel like it's much bigger than tariffs. I think that's another thing that could just cause a tipping point to where companies really start rethinking how imperative and how urgent it is for them to grow their manufacturing operations in the United States.
So Asif, we want to thank you for being with us today. I do have one question that we typically ask to all of our guests. So if you could snap your fingers and have any change come to the industry, what would that be?
That's a great question. And sorry for maybe the untraditional answer, but I addressed a little bit here in my last answer about geopolitical tensions. One of our core values and something that I have tried to very much by design embed into the fabric of our company is one of our four core values, which is kindness. And, you know, I really enjoy even my wonderful competitors in the industry. I think we're in a great industry. I think the world could use a little more kindness. And I think very close to home, what happened with the Blackstone executive in New York, I don't need to describe some of the tensions over the last few weeks in our country, but I think it not only makes me sad, especially reflecting on my own personal story, but I think a little bit of kindness could just go a long way. And I think there's plenty of kindness in our industry already, but the more we project that outwards and work together and take care of each other, I think could really continue to make an impact on the larger world that we operate in.
Excellent. Asif, thank you so much for being with us. I think that is all the time we've got. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and everybody take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.